Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is pleased to welcome a delegation from Leadership Lufkin to the Supreme Court courtroom today. This morning we have two causes that will be submitted for oral argument on our docket, one of our causes having settled. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Celtic Life Insurance Company versus John D. Coates, Jr. from Travis County, and R Communications Incorporated versus the Honorable John Sharp, Controller of Public Accounts from Travis County. In each of these matters, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court, and we will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Celtic Life versus Coates.
May I please report Mr. James Ebank to present argument for petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Ebanks. I'm an attorney from Houston representing Celtic in this case. This is an insurance case presenting essentially three issues to the court for consideration. Issue one, can an insurance company be held vicariously liable for the representations made by a soliciting agent? Question two, should reliance, as that concept is understood, be required in connection with a DTPA or an Article 2121 cause of action as a fundamental element of the plaintiff's recovery? And issue three, is it appropriate for a court to treble prejudgment interest in connection with the entry of a particular judgment?
If you should prevail on issue number one, then the hunt's up and there's no need to go to issue two and three?
That's true. If the court reverses the Court of Appeals on the issue of whether or not the soliciting agent's representations can bind the company, then the result is to reverse and render the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Alternatively, with respect to each of the other two, the result would be to remand or in some respect reform the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
And for you to prevail on issue two, the court would have to revisit Weitzman versus Barnes and adopt my dissent.
That's true, and we've asked the court to do that. And the reason that we've asked the court to do that is based on dissenting opinions as well as other writings that have been done on the issue.
And obviously on an erroneous conclusion of the court.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I'm teasing. Sure. I'm saying an erroneous interpretation of Weitzman versus Barnes, but that's, go ahead with your
argument. Well, the concept on the reliance issue, just to visit with the court briefly on that, is that in proximate cause, we obviously recognize that there's got to be foreseeability and cause in fact. On the issue of producing cause, there still has to be some aspect of cause in fact. If the plaintiff hasn't relied in any respect on the representations made, whether or not they were misrepresentations, whether or not they can be attributed to somebody else, absent cause in fact, there can't have been damages to the plaintiff. And that, speaking facts specific to this particular case, is exactly what we have, because Mr. Coates testified not only would he probably have bought the insurance policy in question anyway, regardless of what Harrell is alleged to have said, but if you'll recall the facts, Harrell never made any misrepresentations or representations directly to Coates. The only question that was framed was, did Harrell say something to Paula Engelman, and then did Paula Engelman in some respect communicate that to Coates? And Coates testified at the trial that he never had any direct conversations with Paula Engelman on the specific issue of what the coverage was, what the coverage was going to provide, this issue of psychiatric care benefits. So with all of those things being before the court from a factual standpoint, there is no reliance factually or as a matter of law, and as a consequence, Coates could not have been damaged by Harrell's representations or misrepresentations, even if they were made.
That is only reliance as an element in a DTPA cause of action.
That's true. And as I said, we've asked the court to look at that.
Can you explain to me why the doctrine of apparent authority would not apply to a soliciting agent as opposed to a recording agent? when in fact it does not rely at all on the actual authority of the agent, but based on an estoppel.
Well, I think the doctrine of apparent authority does apply to the agent. And I think that that's where, if you look at the cases that we're talking about, that's where I think that this Court of Appeals has gone astray. I mean, the plaintiffs have cited Judge Enoch's opinion in Maccabees as fundamental authority in this area, erroneously, I think. I think Judge Enoch was following the Royal Globe logic when he wrote Maccabees. And I think that Maccabees, Lucadou, Montgomery, Guthrie, and all the other cases all say the same thing, and that is that Article 2102, if you look at the statute itself, has been on the books since 1879, essentially unchanged. Article 2102, as the Guthrie Court said, as Lucadou said, and as Royal Globe said, only defines who the persons are that will then be subject to the remainder of Article 21, Chapter 2121, that contains Article 21.21 of the insurance code. Just saying that someone is a, quote, agent, meaning they are a person defined by the insurance code as being subject to the provisions of the chapter and the liabilities and everything else contained within the chapter, does not resolve the issue. Because if it did, then that means that there would be strict liability for anything that an insurance agent said ever. And that can't possibly be the law, and it can't be reconciled with what the court said in Royal Globe. I think the proper way to look at it is to say, okay, we've now got a person. That person is defined as a 21.02 agent. If you assume that the person has made a misrepresentation, the question then becomes who pays for it. If you are attempting to assert vicarious responsibility to the company on behalf of that agent, then you go to the issue of authority. And authority has the multiple prongs to it. Either they have actual authority or apparent authority.
That's at variance with the traditional agency law, where the principal can be liable for the actions of an apparent agent based on the indicia of authority vested by the principal and the agent.
Sure. And that's where I'm going, is on this issue of apparent authority, because most of the cases really deal with the issue of apparent authority rather than actual authority. In Maccabees...
So why do you talk about the actual authority?
Because it's just one of the prongs. And the court can get to vicarious liability on actual authority without ever dealing with apparent authority, because actual authority is more forefront, more blunt, more direct than apparent authority is, and it doesn't rely in any respect on what this insurance company is doing or not doing. In the Maccabees case, you had an employee of Maccabees who was doing all of these things. And the court went through great lengths to talk about the fact that not only did they have a soliciting agent in the Maccabees case, this fellow named Mike Evans, but that the Dallas County Hospital District had determined that they didn't want to deal with the soliciting agent, so they went to the employee of the company, who was Wyburn, who was the fellow in question. And all of the briefs and all of the discussion was really directed at the fundamental concept that this guy was an employee of the company, came out, had the blanket of Maccabees draped around his shoulder, and was making all of these representations to the company, including the fact that he was a person authorized to make statements to bind coverage, to vary the terms and conditions of the policy. In the Coates case, as with Guthrie and Montgomery and Royal Globe, the issue is one of apparent authority. And then it turns to the question of, has this insurance company, Celtic, done something, said something, or otherwise taken actions or failed to take actions that would lead this reasonable person out there who is looking at the insurance transaction to believe that the agent has the authority to change the policy, to vary the conditions, to change the coverages, to go beyond the written word of the policy. And in this case, the answer is no. Because not only do you have...
As a general proposition, would you say the answer is yes?
No. Well, I think in a general proposition, you've got to look at it case by case. I don't think you can broad brush it. And I think that's what the plaintiffs are trying to do, is say that you can broad brush this issue and say that in each and every case, apparent authority exists. But if that's true, there's no reason to have a distinction between the two.
Well, if you have jury findings that will support a judgment based on apparent authority, then would it exist? Could that apparent agent bind the insurance company?
Of course. In this case, there is no jury finding on apparent authority, and the reason is because apparent authority wasn't even an issue in the case because of Coates' admissions that he knew from the very outset that Harrell didn't have apparent authority, couldn't bind, couldn't change the terms of the policy, et cetera, and all those questions I think are in Statement of Facts, pages 106, 107, somewhere in that general range. But in direct answer to your question, if you don't have to deal with actual authority and you go the route of apparent authority and you submit issues on apparent authority and there are findings of apparent authority, even if they're phrased in terms of would a reasonably prudent person buying insurance believe this guy, then you can assess vicarious liability.
Let me be sure I've got that clear. First of all, the insurance salesman in this case had been a recording agent and had done the same thing, and he had the same findings. Would Celtic be liable?
Yes.
And if the insurance agent not being a insurance salesman not being a recording agent, had the jury findings on apparent authority, you would also be liable.
Yes. If he was a soliciting agent.
Soliciting agent.
Taking the Royal Globe distinction and saying that we mean what we say when we say that there is a distinction, and that one, a local recording agent, that the issue of authority really is irrelevant because recording agent by definition encompasses within it the concept of actual authority. Therefore, you don't have to go on. So putting that aside and saying we're talking about soliciting agents, independent contractors, people who are out there like Harrell with the opportunity to visit independently, are not controlled by the company, and don't have a limitation on the products that they can sell because they can go out and offer various products, then you turn to apparent authority, and if there are findings on it, then that is how you satisfy the vicarious liability question.
I understand that this distinction between recording and soliciting agents has some legal significance, but would the ordinary person have any way of knowing that somebody walks in their store to peddle some insurance, whether they are a recording agent or a soliciting agent?
I think it's dependent on the facts of the case. I mean, on the facts of this case, in theory, they are going to know the difference if the definition of a local recording agent is the kind of guy who is more of a captured agent, employee of the insurance company, hands out their cards, you know, wears their jacket with the blazer patch or whatever. With a guy like this, it's clear that from the actions and the conduct and the dialogue between the two parties that Mr. Coates, not only because of his previous experience in dealing with insurance, but based on what Harrell was telling him, was clearly aware of the fact that Harrell was an independent soliciting agent, if for no other reason than Coates testified he never even heard the name Celtic until you got well into the transaction. And Harrell was operating out of these time insurance agency offices, which clearly didn't have a connection between Celtic in that sense.
Can you touch on the prejudgment interest a little bit in your remaining?
Sure, before I run out of time. Let me point out to the court that since the briefs were filed, there is a new opinion on prejudgment interest. It is called Southern Life Health Insurance Company versus Alfaro, A-L-F-A-R-O, out of the Court of Appeals for San Antonio, opinion February 26, 1993, which disagrees with the Court of Appeals in Celtic, agrees with the Supreme Court in Vail and the other cases that say that prejudgment interest is not to be trebled. And Alfaro essentially addresses the prejudgment interest from the same standpoint that we've addressed it in our briefs by saying that Vail says you don't treble punitive damages or additional damages. The clear idea of prejudgment interest is to compensate an individual for lost use of money, not lost use of punitive damages, not lost use of additional damages, but lost use of actual damages. And in this case, Mr. Coates' actual damages were found to be $17,000, regardless of how the law operates from the standpoint of the statute to treble or add additional damages. His money that he lost the use of, arguably, is still just the $17,000. Vail says very clearly, you don't treble it. The Austin court, I think, is playing arithmetical games with us when they say that Vail says you don't treble it, but if you take prejudgment interest and you add it in as actual damages and then you treble it, it doesn't violate Vail, but it's doing the same exact thing. It's just arithmetically adding prejudgment interest into the equation as opposed to outside the parentheses of the equation, and there isn't logically any difference between doing it one way or the other.
Isn't the whole concept of prejudgment interest to try to keep the person who's been damaged even and to give them roughly the same dollar value of damages as they would have had if they had not been damaged in the first place?
Sure, if they had taken the $17,000 and gone and invested it at 10% compounded daily. But by trebling it, you're not keeping them even, and you're not putting them in the same position that they would have been in, because what you're doing is giving them the opportunity to invest $54,000 rather than $17,000, and that clearly is what's prescribed by theory.
Well, but if the prejudgment interest is designed to keep them even and give them the true amount of damages considering the decline in value of the dollar that they would have had, why is the prejudgment interest any different than the rest of their actual damages?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but if the theory is to take Mr. Coates and put him in the same position as he would have been in, then all you look at is his actual damages, because the punitive damages or the additional damages are exactly that, theoretically assigned for purposes of punishment or deterrence to prevent further conduct and to send the signal to the society, etc. And with that theory in mind, you are triple penalizing this company and triple compensating the plaintiff by trebling the prejudgment interest.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Court, Mr. Philip Maxwell will present argument from respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. The prejudgment interest question I think I'd like to address. This is the last one addressed by the court. Prejudgment interest has been held by this court to be actual damage. This is the whole fundamental reason for the Kavner opinion. It has historically been held without ever a dissent that what the actual damages term means in the DDPA and in the insurance code is common law damages. Common law damages were held in Kavner to include prejudgment interest. Is a simple application of the statute's terms, which says in a situation in which now a conduct is committed knowingly, you multiply the damages by 3. Under the statute under which this was tried, it was the pre-85 Article 21.21 that did not require finding of knowingly, but the operation of the statute is the same, 3 times actual damages. You can't say on the one hand that prejudgment interest is actual damages because that's the only reason you award them anyway, and then say, however, they're not actual damages for purposes of trebling. And moreover, it seems to me that the words in the Stewart Title versus Sterling opinion are germane here, where the court rejected defendant's request that the amounts paid in settlement prior to trial should be deducted from the amount of actual damages prior to trebling. The court rejected that because they were concerned that this would undermine the deterrent effect of treble damages. And so the court held that you trebled the damages and then deducted any amount of monies paid by way of pretrial settlement. And it seems to me if you deduct from actual damages prejudgment interest before you treble, then you are really running the same risk, courting the same harm that you sought to avoid in Stewart Title.
Do we have to modify some of the language in Vail to reach that result?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the prejudge, I understand the arithmetic same result, but the point is that you are not awarding prejudgment interest on punitive damages because punitive damages are not actual damages. And so the statement in Vail, and the which was, by the way, the statement in Kavner, because the defendant sought prejudgment interest not only of their past actual damages but future actual damage as well as punitive damages. This court rejected it, and the very terse sentence in Vail was simply a citation to Kavner, and the request that the prejudgment interest be awarded on punitive damages. And so I don't think there's any reason to change Vail. I think the Court of Appeals reconciliation of Vail with the trebling of prejudgment interest as part of actual damages by the Court of Appeals in this case is ample to the task. The issue of authority, I want you to read to you, this is from the Vice President of Celtic at page 269 and 270. Mr. Thomas Stead and Justice Cornyn, hopefully this is responsive to some of the questions you posed to counsel. Question, it would be totally proper for an agent to engage in an explanation of the provisions of the policy that are found in these brochures, correct? Answer, yes. Question, in fact, it would be most often, most frequently, probably be necessary to do that, to explain more fully the terms that are found in the brochure. Answer, yes, if it was going to sell it. Question, because most of the time people have questions about that coverage, about what the coverage is, right? Answer, that's right. All of that appearing at the bottom of page 269, line 24 through page 270, line 9.
And that evidence, you would say, supports the jury's answer to question number two?
Absolutely.
Is question number two an apparent authority issue?
Actually, the jury was instructed, I have to beg to differ with counsel, that the authority issue was defined by instruction at the bottom of transcript 24 as actual and apparent authority. The jury was charged that the word authority meant either actual, which is either expressed or implied, or apparent. And then they were asked the question, did Ken Harrell have authority to explain on behalf of Celtic the benefits of the insurance policy?
Was that the only mention of apparent authority? In other words, what I'm interested in is whether apparent authority itself was further defined or whether the failure to define it was an objection.
No. Number one, there was no objection to the court's charge as to what authority was. Apparent authority was defined in the way that I think you were, your questions indicated you would have defined it and probably did when you were sitting on the trial bench. Apparent authority means such authority as a reasonably prudent person using diligence and discretion in view of the insurance company's conduct would naturally and reasonably suppose the agent to possess. And then it goes on and on. In similar vein, I won't detain us with, but you know, an insurance company may so clothe an agent with signs or indications of authority so as to lead a reasonably prudent person to believe that the agent actually has such authority.
And that's what I was interested in. That's on
transcript TR 24 is the entire instruction on authority, including the apparent part of it.
I don't see how the necessity that a salesman explain the product is binding on the maker of the product. If I go to a real retail store and want to know the difference between this and that, some salesman will probably come over and tell me what he thinks, but I don't suppose for a moment that that is a representation by either manufacturer of the equipment.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, how you conduct yourself in your retail transactions does suggest a prudence that was not among the presumptions of the legislature in passing the DTPA, and there is countless legislative history and countless judicial opinions that the purpose of this statute is to protect the ignorant, the unthinking, and the credulous.
All right, let's take personalities out. If you go into a retail store and a salesman explains to you what he thinks the characteristics of a product are those representations by the manufacturer?
They're representations of the person for whom he works, and the person for whom he works is the store, the retailer.
Why aren't they representations on behalf of the manufacturer? Because the manufacturer, like this vice president, knows that those characteristics will have to be explained by someone in order to sell a product.
Because under the terms of the insurance code, which provides in 2102, that when anybody is making a representation concerning the solicitation of an insurance policy, he is the agent, agent of the insurance company. 2102, and as a matter of fact, it goes on, 21.04 says, in a controversy between the insured and the insurance company over an insurance policy, the the agent will be held to be the agent of the company and not of the insured in that controversy. And you cannot read those sections and then go on to read the regulations under the insurance code, by the way, which the term misrepresentation was taken from. Those provisions say no matter what the capacity of the person making the representation, these govern. It also says that these sections govern whether or not directly or indirectly done. And you can't read all of those sections without knowing that the legislature intended that insurance companies who they appoint to represent their policies to the public are going to be held liable when those policies are misrepresented.
You mean agents?
I mean agents, pardon me.
But in without those statutory provisions, you don't suggest, for example, in a hypothetical that there would be liable.
I would suggest that if the jury is instructed, as this jury was instructed, as to what authority is, and they've answered the question yes on the evidence of that case, then yes, that the answer would be yes, because all principal agent matters are governed by actual apparent and express authority analysis and the instructions in the court's charge, so charge. And you know, in Royal Globe too, Your Honor, the court was very concerned about the issue of agents. As a matter of fact, an opposing liability, the court said it may be harsh at times to impose upon a company the liability for an agent's representation that they don't know it were even made and that they'd even instructed the agent not to do. And they said, the court then cited Learned Hand's opinion in the FTC case and said, as between the innocent manufacturer or principal and the innocent policyholder, then it is he who chooses the agent upon which the risk of a misrepresentation should fall. At least they have the ability to train their agents, to instruct their agents, to otherwise control the way the agents make their representations.
Was the court in Royal Grove down so careful to talk about the distinction between soliciting agents and recording agents? What does all that discussion mean? And isn't, in fact, when you have an independent agent who may represent 10 or 12 companies, isn't it the customer who's choosing that agent to help the customer sort through this myriad of technical language?
Yes, I'm obviously the latter part is true because very few of us, me included, understand all the technical terms of an insurance policy and rely on insurance professionals to make representations and to explain coverages. I think all of us do that. The discussion in Royal Globe between soliciting and recording agents has to do with the ability to bind the company contractually.
What possible difference could that make if 2102 subsumes all that? I mean, what difference does it make contractually if you've got a DTE agent?
I don't think it does make any difference. I think 2102 answers the question. I think the discussion in Royal Globe between recording and soliciting agents has spawned a lot of confusion that was totally unnecessary because my answer is that recording agents under the state board's regulations and under the statutes have the power to contractually bind the company because the insurance code treats the recording agent as the company. So it's contractual analysis, and it was not germane to the decision in Royal Globe that all that recording and soliciting agent discussion. Also, I noticed recently this court's opinion in May versus United Service Association of America, which is now at 844 Southwest 2nd, 656. At footnote 8, this court says, although the code does distinguish in some context between local recording agents and soliciting agents, this categorization does not apply to agents selling life, health, and accident insurance. Because this case involves only the sale of a health insurance policy, we do not address the differing duties imposed on Texas local recording agents and soliciting agents. So I would suggest to you that not only is the local recording agent, soliciting agent distinction not germane for purposes of Royal Globe, it's not germane in this case, as this court has recognized in its footnote 8 in the May case. On the issue of reliance, the Supreme Court in the Weitzel case relied upon a specific incorporation in the bill that was filed that massively amended the DTPA in 79, a piece of legislation that had among its component parts a specific adoption of reliance. Specifically in 1750, the words adversely affected, which had been the test, were going to be stricken out and the words relied upon were going to be added. That was dropped from the legislation in favor of producing cause. In light of that legislative history, the Weitzel Court could not find its way clear to imply reliance back into the statute when the legislature had just considered whether or not to include it and had rejected it.
Mr. Maxwell, you don't think that logically reliance is a factor in producing cause? An element of producing cause?
It can be. It also, there are certain parts of the laundry list in 1746 that can't be relied on. Rolling back an odometer, multi-level distributorships are absolutely forbidden by the laundry list. In 21.21, the sections, in Article 4, Section 4 of 2121, which will specifically list practices that are actionable under Section 16, include such unreliable on things as defamation, boycott, coercion, and intimidation, unfair discrimination in the setting of rates, and you can't rely. Reliance is not a part of a cause of action in which those laundry list items would be involved because you don't rely on those things. These practices are prohibited themselves. They have caused damage.
But here we're talking about an alleged misrepresentation.
Absolutely. But
you don't think that when we have a cause of action dealing with an alleged misrepresentation, that reliance on that misrepresentation to buy the product is an element of producing cause?
It may be an element of producing cause. It also may not be an element of producing cause because the damages are caused by the falsity of the misrepresentation. Had the representation been true, there would have been no damages.
But here we had a situation where the buyer of the product stated that he was going to buy that product, the insurance policy in question, whether or not the representation had been made.
That's not true. That's an erroneous representation of the record. The witness testified that he was, upon cross-examination, he was asked, there's a possibility you could have bought that that policy anyway, if you'd have read it. He said, it's a possibility. Yes, it was a possibility. His old coverage was ending. Under COBRA, the federal statute, and under state law, he had the right to convert that policy, had an absolute right to convert that policy, and it had $20,000 limits on the psychiatric care. So after telling an agent that he wants at least as good at or better coverage, and after having a terrible conversation with the agent in which both parties, the agent and Mr. Coates, talk about their mutual problems with psychiatric problems of their sons, and this agent leaves and goes away and comes back with a policy and a brochure that says, and you can see it, this is Exhibit 3, you can see it from the bench, $1 million, doesn't leave the brochure with Mr. Coates, or goes away from him, and Mr. Coates is asked subsequently, well, based on what Mr. Harrell told you, you were sort of already inclined to buy that policy anyway. Well, yes, I was, based on what Mr. Harrell told me. So, it's a clear situation where the agent knows what it is that the insured wants, comes back and represents that it's going to have $1 million in coverage, doesn't show him the tiny print that discusses the psychiatric thing when he entrusts to his office personnel the job of going and being duly diligent and discussing it. The agent tells her, according to her testimony, that this only applies if it's an outpatient care.
Of course, all of your comments simply say that if we determine that reliance is a necessary element, then this has to go back to trial court for a new trial. Your issue is that reliance is not an issue in the case, and so what you're talking about, the facts, is not really a material.
No.
You're just saying he said that this covered it, and did it produce damages?
No.
And on the issue of reliance, you're saying reliance is not an issue in this case.
My point is, number one, under the law of deceptive trade practices and the insurance code, when you ask for a question on reliance to be submitted to the jury, you are not entitled to it because it is not part of the plaintiff's case. If you're asking me whether or not there was reliance in this case,
no,
as a part of a factor of producing cause, the answer to that question is yes. And I think, to go further, I think that if reliance is anything in this area, anything at all, it can't be, and I'm going to come back because I missed my end of my thought over here, that reliance could at best be an inferential rebuttal issue because it tends to negative. You did not rely, tends to negative the producing cause, but at best it would be an inferential rebuttal issue. As a matter of fact, the court at Industry Chem versus Parpack, in dealing with the warranty, you know, it was the prejudgment interest trebling case, but it went on to talk about reliance, and the defendant there said, well, listen, you know, I really need to have a reliance issue on this breach of warranty. And the court said, no, reliance is not a part of the UCC, not the CTPA analysis. Under the UCC, you don't get reliance. And they said, well, maybe in a proper case, maybe it might tend to negative the basis of a warranty, which is basis of the bargain. It's got to be a basis of the bargain to have a warranty, and it tend to negative basis of the bargain. But it said, at best, it would be an inferential rebuttal issue, and it should be termed with the word not. Not rely. Did he not rely? No question was asked in that way in this case. No inferential rebuttal instruction was requested. A burden of proof on the plaintiff requested instruction was made by the defendants in this case, which was properly rejected by the trial court. Now, Justice Gonzalez, let me briefly conclude. In Rio Grande Oil Company versus State, and I'll get the side because it's not in the brief, and this is not fair to bring up a case that's not been cited. Rio Grande Oil Company versus State, the Houston Court of Appeals had before it a securities case. The Attorney General was seeking to get an injunction based on violations, and they have a laundry list in the Securities Act. The defendants claimed that the injunction could not properly issue because there was no reliance, no showing of reliance on the part of the investors on the securities violations by the defendants. They were within the definition of securities fraud in the Securities Act. The court rejected that because on the analysis that I was going through, they said, look at this laundry list of things that are securities fraud. One of them is charging commissions that are grossly unconscionable. You can't rely on that. So it said you can't have varying proof requirements. You can't have varying different issues depending on which of these elements of the definition of fraud you take out. And so it rejected reliance, citing a Court of a Criminal Appeals case, Birchfield versus State, which the Court of Criminal Appeals did precisely the same thing because it would invite varying burdens of proof depending on which element of your definition you were using.
Let me see if I understand your argument. You're saying that reliance then, that the defendant is not entitled to submission of either an issue or an instruction on reliance, but he can argue to the jury that reliance is part and parcel of proximate of cruising cause.
He can argue it all day long.
Is that what your argument is?
They argue it all day long and do.
You're not entitled to an issue, but you're entitled to argue about it.
Oh, sure.
And you're not entitled to an instruction.
I say not.
Oh. I understand your argument.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. With regard to the reliance element, how many times has the legislature revisited the DTPA since our opinion in Weitzel?
Probably at least a couple.
At some point, don't we have to? Hasn't this court held that the stare decisis is the strongest in statutory interpretation matters, much stronger than either common law or constitutional interpretation?
Sure, Judge, and we talk about harsh results and everything else. You know, we come back to the issue of what makes common sense, though, and let's don't lose sight of what makes common sense when we start talking about stare decisis or the legislature's action versus inaction et cetera. I mean, common sense says that all of the bad acts in the world having been taken for granted, if for some reason you don't change your position on those bad acts to your detriment, then you haven't been damaged. And that's what this concept of reliance really is addressing, is the concept that Ken Harrell can say that this particular policy has an unlimited benefit for everything in the world or not. But if the purchaser of the policy doesn't adjust, doesn't change, doesn't do something different based on those statements, then he hasn't been damaged at all. Touching on prejudgment interest very quickly, every single case that supports the trebling of prejudgment interest is a no-writ case. All of the cases that this court has addressed from the standpoint of prejudgment interest since Vail have all been courts of appeals decisions that prejudgment interest was not to be trebled because it was inappropriate under Vail to treble them, and this court has either writ refused those cases or refused writ no reversible error. So the only cases that the plaintiffs can cite here in support of their position are no writ cases. May versus USAA, which was brought up, says, if you read the footnote, Article 21.14, which deals with casualty insurers, is the one that makes the distinction between recording and soliciting agents and says that that particular distinction isn't applicable to health and life carriers because Article 21.14 is a statute that specifically addresses casualty coverage, automobile policies, your State Farms, your Allstates, etc. This court, since 1973 in the Fink case, and then again in 1979 with Royal Globe, has clearly recognized that there's a difference between the quality of an agent. You've got local recording agents, you've got soliciting agents. They are all, quote, agents as defined by Section 21.02, and they are all people as defined by that statute who are then subject to the terms and conditions and liabilities of Chapter 21 of the Insurance Code. But you cannot stop the analysis there. Because if you do, as I mentioned earlier, you do what Mr. Maxwell just said, and you paint a broad brush, strict liability on every single insurance carrier in the state for every statement made by every single agent in the state, regardless of what the quality of his agency is. And I submit to you that if we do that, and if we make this departure from the concept of there being distinctions in quality of agency, then there's no reason to have policies because no longer is the four corners of the document, no longer is the written word of the policy ever going to control as long as you can go out and have a person defined by 21.02 make a statement that is at variance with that policy. Justice Cornyn, to address your issue on the question of apparent authority in this particular court's charge, authority was defined. But question number two doesn't have anything to do with Mr. Harrell making misrepresentations about this policy that vary with the terms of the written document. What question two basically says, if you want to boil it down to everyday common sense language, is can Ken Harrell and John Coates talk about this insurance policy? And not a thing more than that. The reason question three was submitted is to clearly and directly ask the jury whether or not Ken Harrell had the authority, actual or apparent, to make any sort of representations to John Coates which were different than what was set forth in writing.
Can you explain to me what the difference between the authority to explain and the authority to represent is?
Well, authority to explain, I don't think, goes any farther than to simply address the concept that Mr. Stead talked about in his testimony, that it is recognized that people are going to have to sit down, not in a vacuum, but they're going to have to sit down and talk about insurance, and they're going to have to talk about needs, and they're going to have to talk in generalities about coverage. But there's a very wide canyon of difference between talking about the insurance policy and going a step further and not making misrepresentations, because no insurance company is going to authorize that, making representations about the coverage of the policy that are different from what the policy provides. And let me conclude with this thought. Mr. Longley's office...
Is this an answer to a question?
Yes, it is. Mr. Longley's office talks about a lot of factual scenarios where you've got the agent goes out and talks to mom and dad on the front porch, and they are totally ignorant, and they don't have any information in front of them, and as a consequence, all they have to rely on is the statements of the agent, and that is a far cry difference from what we have here, where you clearly have the written record in front of you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Governor. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.